Hey, welcome to night school. It is a true night school. True. It's 11:34 at night. And what we're going to be talking about today is manhood and madness. And I feel like these topics are eternal, and they have a million different contexts. Throughout time, and even just for this time, for right now, those things have a million different contexts. So I'm just going to talk about them at best, you know, the best way that I can right now. I'm not going to try to, you know, completely put a wrap on the subject. This is the only podcast you'll ever need to listen to about manhood. This is the only podcast you'll ever need to listen to about madness. I wrote the book. I wrote the book on manhood. I wrote the book on madness. No, I don't feel like I'm going to have to completely define these things, but let's try to define them. Let's try to define what is manhood. I know for me there is physical manhood. There's a period of time when you stop growing. It's when you stop growing, but there is a point in time where you become the largest you're going to be. You resemble a man, and I had this experience when I was probably about 20 years old. I was in a grocery store, and a little kid got in my way, and kids are always getting in your way in a grocery store. There's something about kids in grocery stores. When they're not sitting in the cart, they're probably getting in your way, especially if they have that little mini cart, that little mini grocery shopping cart. Those things only exist so that kids can get in your way, because you don't need training. Let me just say this. You don't need training on how to push a grocery cart. You reach an age where you are physically able to push that cart, and it is so obvious how to do it that you don't need to have had practice doing it as a little kid with a miniature little cart. So the only reason those tiny little shopping carts exist is so that kids who are already getting in your way in the grocery store can get even further in your way. They can get in your way in an even worse way with those little shopping carts. But anyway, I was in a grocery store and a little kid got in my way. And the mom turned around and said, "Oh, honey, get out of the man's way." And it was just a little comment, you know? I mean, it was just a mom saying something. But it hit me. I was like, I am viewed as a man now. And, you know, I hadn't grown any taller for probably the previous 3 years. You know, I was still the exact same size I was when I was 17. And, you know, it's not like the mom would have said when I was 17, "Get out of the boy's way. Get out of that kid's way. Hey, honey, get out of the boy's way." You know, it's not like she would have said that. But still, just I think this was the first time that I had ever heard a stranger say, "Get out of the man's way." And a mom has a certain level of authority, not just with her child. She has a lot of authority with her child. She communicated to her child that I was a man approaching, but it also has authority with everybody around her. Even if someone's a shitty mom, even if they're a bad mom, there's a certain authority to a mom speaking, to a mom saying something. And this mom basically pinned a badge on my lapel. Not that I had a lapel, but let's just say I didn't have a badge either. So let's just say I had a lapel too. She basically pinned a badge onto my lapel with her voice that just said "man" on it. For all intents and purposes, I had the silhouette of a man. But I didn't feel like a man. And I feel like that's common, you know. I feel like some people go through life never really feeling like a man. But I think it's especially true for my generation, especially in our 20s. I was about 20 years old, and I was born 1985, and I know very few people in my age range, give or take a few years, who felt like a man in their 20s. There are some people who might have had a kid. They might have started a family early, which that even says a lot that starting a family in your 20s would be considered starting a family early. That says a lot about how the delayed manhood of my generation, the fact that that would even be considered late. But still, you think about a dad, you know, when you become a father, somebody who becomes a father, something is sacrificed. If they're even a halfway decent father, they're sacrificing all kinds of little whims and hobbies and interests and ideas that they just won't have time to care about. That guy won't go, "Oh, he had a son at age 20. He's not going to go on to start Every Night's a School Night podcast. You know, and if he does, it's going to be just about how grateful he is for his kids, and nobody's going to listen to it. Not that anybody listens to this. I don't want to make everybody's going to listen to the podcast about how grateful you are about your kids. What am I talking about? But no, but still, like, so much is sacrificed when someone becomes a father. And if they're a really good father, like one of those just great fathers, an inspirational father, they are going to sacrifice so much bullshit that they no longer have time or the will to care about, because they are going to focus on their wife and kids and, you know, whatever else you do to raise a family. Your priorities shift. But, you know, most men of my generation really don't have kids too early. We kind of stay, I mean, especially with video games and all of that, you have men who, like, their entire focus throughout their adult life to this point, even in 2019, into their 30s and 40s, has been, let's say, video games. And I'm not criticizing that. I'm just saying that, you know, it's their interest is still the same exact thing they were interested in when they were 8 years old. And, you know, so in that way, it's, you know, it's weird being part of this and not really feeling like a man when you are physically a man, when you've reached a certain stage of maturation. I don't know how to pronounce that. It sounds wrong either way I say it. When you have physically matured to the point where a mom in a grocery store refers to you as a man, but yet you don't feel like one. And, you know, for me, you know, you can point out, you can find some obvious rites of passage. There are certain things that you do in life that kind of put you on that path to some form of manhood. And a lot of people would point out sex once you've, quote unquote, crossed that threshold. Quite literally, some might say that you are now a man. Oh, you never gotten laid? You ain't a man. You ain't a man. And I think it's important. I think you do have to have lost your virginity to some degree, not lost your virginity to some degree, but I think that to some degree, that's important. And not because the act itself is important. And calling it an act sounds so disgusting. When you call something an act, the act sounds disgusting. But I don't think the act is so much as important to being a man as the idea of it. Because I think if you've never lost your virginity, and you're even a semi-normal man in that regard, you're always going to have this insecurity eating at you. And I don't think the act of sex itself is necessary on the path to being a man or embodying manhood. But I think if you haven't had sex, you have this insecurity that is going to gnaw at you. And that insecurity itself is what's going to prevent you from fully becoming a man. So it's not about whether or not you've had sex. It's basically minimizing the number of pointless insecurities that are going to eat away at you over the years. oh man, that's it. That's exactly it. And so in that way, you know, I don't think somebody's virginity or celibacy or anything like that really has any weight on whether or not they are truly a man. And I mean, you can look at monks. Are you going to say that a monk is not a man because they've taken a vow of celibacy? I mean, monks are essentially aliens. They're bald. They wear strange clothing. They live their ascetic lifestyles. They're ascetic aesthetic. They got an ascetic aesthetic. But really, I mean, aside from the alien appearance and the strange asexuality of monks, I don't think they're less men. I don't know if manhood is important to them, but I think monks embody actually a powerful form of manhood. So just because they aren't sexual beings and they aren't actively engaged in sex, I mean, assuming they aren't just fucking each other, you know, because God knows, I bet a lot of monks do. I don't think an asexual monk is any less of a man for choosing that lifestyle or that lifestyle choosing him. But on the other hand, too, you know, I don't think that there's any virtue in being a womanizer. Because the thing about womanizers, and I know I pointed this out on an Every Night's a School Night episode, but the crazy thing about womanizers is they're not just in it for the sheer pleasure. There's this idea, oh, they just want to get laid a lot because it feels good. They just want to get laid a lot. You know, it's not just about that. I'm not saying that's not a big part of it. I'm not saying womanizers don't enjoy sex. But I will say that a lot of womanizers womanize to the extent that they do to assert dominance over other men. It's why you hear these asides where men like to point out, like, oh, you know, Jimmy's dating Jenny now. I fucked the first. Or even worse than that, when it's like, oh, Jimmy's married to Jenny. I fucked her last week. She and I, we hook up, you know. I hooked up with her yesterday. You know, men like to do that to assert dominance over each other, even if it's a lie, because men will lie about that. They will lie about sleeping with women just to, like, impress the people in their immediate, to impress the people that they are around at that moment. They will lie about having slept with some other guy's wife, or even if they did do it, they will tell the guys around them, like, it gives them some kind of, you know, it just gives them something, some power, some dominance. And you see that in tribes, too, where there's this, or cults. Let's just jump from tribes to cults. You see it where the cult leader inevitably screws all the women in the cult, or even some of the men, maybe all the men. The cult leader screws everybody. And part of that is the dominance. The cult leader is the chief, the chieftain of the tribe, and he's got to, you know, fuck everybody's wives. He's got to screw everybody because that's how he asserts dominance. And that's kind of what womanizers are doing. They're kind of, it's a way of kind of, you know, it's something they have over everybody else around them. The more women you've slept with, you know, the more men are therefore somehow less than you or subservient to you. And there's obviously a lot wrong with that. So needless to say, despite what some men think, getting laid a lot or, and I say that very tongue-in-cheek because I think that's like one of the dumbest ways of expressing that. Getting laid. You gotten laid lately? It's one of the most disgusting, dumbest ways of expressing that idea. Expressing. It's just an expression, man. But really, I think it is. And so, but just the idea that, you know, you have to assert your manhood or your manhood is somehow defined by the amount of sex you have, that's wrong. You know, even though I think it's necessary for a man to get past certain insecurities by actually having had lost his virginity, to say the least, I also think the opposite extreme of that, which is to, like, try to sleep with as many women as possible, I think that that actually takes away from someone's manhood. Especially because, as I was saying, that the womanizer who is actually womanizing because on some deeper level he wants to assert dominance over other men, kind of gay. And not that there's anything wrong with being gay itself, not that there's anything wrong with being a homosexual who likes to sleep with other men, but when you are asserting your dominance over other men by sleeping with women, that's kind of gay, and it's the wrong kind of gay. It's kind of like fucking men in prison to prove, you know, that you are more straight than them. You know what I mean? Which does happen. There's this weird, if you've ever read about prison psychology, especially behind prison rape, there's so much twisted logic going on where self-professed straight men will do, I don't want to get into that. It's darker than even this, you know, but still, there's all kinds of twisted logic. And so the wrong kind of gay is that. Being just straight up gay, nothing wrong with it. The wrong kind of gay is trying to assert dominance over other men by doing weird underhanded shit. Let's just say that. And then, you know, there's the idea of the virtuous man, too, who marries his high school sweetheart. It's the only person he's ever been involved with. They're like two mallard ducks who stay together forever. And I like that idea. Personally, I love that idea. That would be me in an ideal world. Mate for life. It's not me, though, ultimately, and there's not necessarily any greater moral virtue to that, though. Even though it's a nice story, it's a nice storybook story, it's still, to me, it's not necessarily any, doesn't make you any more of a man because you married your high school sweetheart and you've only ever been involved with one woman. Even though, to me, that's a better ideal than other options, just me being me, wired the way I am, I still don't see it as superior or some greater definition of someone's manhood. And I think the greater point in all of this is just that I don't see, you know, sex itself as a necessary aspect in defining manhood. You want to get past certain crutches or insecurities. You don't want to be the lecherous Tex Avery Wolf with your eyeballs shooting out of your head. And that's my favorite cartoon character, the Tex Avery Wolf. His eyeballs shoot out of his head. The way he drinks alcohol was so much like I was when I drank, where the wolf is in some sort of club, some like 1920s club, like a speakeasy or something. And he has this tall glass of some cocktail and he holds it up to his lips ever so slowly, like he's just going to sip it, and then he just gulps it down. That was literally how I drank. I would get cocktails, sometimes doubles, and just be like, oh, I'm just going to sip this. And the second I hold it up to my lips, it's down my throat. But the wolf would get lecherous and like animal lecher. You heard of Hannibal Lecter? Hannibal Lecter? You heard of Hannibal Lecter? Well, I'm animal lecher. A lecherous animal. And that's what that wolf was, that cartoon wolf. He would get very lecherous. He would see a woman walk in. His eyeballs would shoot out of his head. The steam whistle would, like, shoot out of his ears. Like this weird, like, crazy, like, 10 steam whistles stacked on each other, crisscrossing, would shoot out and go off. His tongue would roll out. You know, that classic image of, like, the wolf's tongue just rolling out as his eyes are popping out. Men do act that way. Men become that caricature, both because men can be that. Men can be that lecherous, and they also sometimes think that they're supposed to be. So needless to say, you know, that wolf isn't any more of a man than a wolf who, I don't know, is a virgin alien monk, you know? But at the same time, I don't know. I think there's a balance to that. And I think that everybody's different. I think everybody's wired a little bit different. And you shouldn't give in to the way other men think you should behave around women. You shouldn't give in to, like, I don't know. Just needless to say, I don't think that your manhood is defined by the amount of sex you have or how much tail you chase. It ain't defined by how much tail you chase. It's not as important as it seems, as long as you've worked through whatever insecurities you have that are correlated with your sexuality. So what is manhood? If it's not a, if you know, what is your, you know, emotional, psychological, mental manhood? We know what physical manhood is. That's when a mom in a grocery store calls you a man. And we know it's not just your dick. So what is it? What is it to be a man? And I've thought about the things, the macho things that just from an early age drew me in. The things that bring a tear to my eye. There's this whole idea out there that, you know, you've heard the idea that, like, men don't let each other cry. And it's a line you see that the far left uses it. They'll talk about, you know, men don't let each other cry, and that's an aspect of toxic masculinity. I think men do let each other cry. I know there are macho men who, once again, I think a theme here is going to be pointing out insecurity. There are quote-unquote macho men who will attack another man if he shows a tear, no matter the circumstances. But in my experience, men are very accepting of other men crying if the circumstances allow it, and it's not over the top. And I think an example of that is the movie Platoon. There's a scene where, and it's been about 16 years since I've seen this movie, but this part is fresh in my brain because it brings a tear to my eye every fucking time I see it. And it's when Elias, Willem Dafoe's character, has been left for dead. He's been betrayed and left for dead in the jungle. And the rest of the platoon gets on a helicopter and they're leaving. And the soundtrack, that beautiful fucking over-the-top Platoon soundtrack, is just piping. It's loud. It's grown so loud. And the helicopter's flying away, and it's this climax in the movie, and you think Elias, Willem Dafoe, is dead in the jungle, and all of a sudden he comes running out of the jungle with the flares in his hands, and he drops to his knees as the music just peaks, and that scene will bring a fucking tear to your eye. There's something about just, and that's not even the glory of war. It's hard to even put to words what that scene is capturing, but there's something about just them being warriors, him being betrayed, you thinking he's dead, him running out of the jungle against all odds as his friends fly away in a helicopter and the music plays. And there is not a macho man in the world who will watch that. In the world, whether they're in Texas or Laos, Laos, and, you know, no matter where they are, there's not a man who will be ashamed to have a tear in his eye. I'm reading a book, The Wheel of Time, and there's a scene. I'm reading the series, The Wheel of Time, not just one book. It's 14 fucking books. And there's a scene in the second book where a character reveals that he had betrayed the other good guys earlier in the story, and he wants to redeem himself, and he does so by fighting off 50 bad guys by himself in an alleyway while the rest of the good guys escape. And just the way that scene built, it's a classic scenario, you know, it's a classic story. But just the way everything built to that one part brought a tear to my eye. And it made me think about sacrifice. I talked earlier about the idea of a father sacrificing for his family, and a mother will do that too. That's the thing, is just because I feel like something defines someone as a man doesn't mean the same exact qualities don't define a woman as a woman for doing the same thing. We don't exist in this world where these things are mutually exclusive, if I'm even using that phrase right. I feel like I am. I feel it. But, you know, I talked about that sort of practical sacrifice where a father, you know, he gives up his dreams of being a singer-songwriter so that he can just work hard for his kid and give him a good life and a good Christmas and be a good dad. And that's a noble sacrifice because while it does get a certain amount of credit in our society, and, you know, when he does decide to audition for American Idol, they're going to harp on that story before he goes up and sings. While our society does, you know, put that behavior on a pedestal, it's also kind of boring. You know, it's sort of that boring sacrifice, and it's noble, and a lot of noble things are boring, but there's something about the idea of that, like, warrior sacrifice that really does something for me and brings a tear to my eye. And just to finish up on the tear topic, because I don't really want to go on about that, I think that men are completely accepting of other men crying over real personal tragedies. I don't think a man, you know, throughout any age, throughout any era, is going to deeply attack another man for crying, you know, over one of his loved ones dying, over his child dying, his family member dying. You know, like I said, there might be some horribly insecure man who will, but I feel like that person is the exception, and we shouldn't define this, like, war on crying based on the behavior of several exceptions. And maybe I'm wrong, I don't know, but I have experience as a man, and this is what I've experienced. Men don't attack criers as much as you think. People who cry over bullshit, yeah, I'm bothered by anybody who cries over bullshit, even a baby. Even a baby pushing a mini shopping cart crying, you know, that even that bothers me. But I don't think men are as bothered by other men crying. I just think sometimes we want it to be for the right reasons. And when someone seems like they're whining or crying out of turn, it does bother us. And women don't like it either. If you've ever had a girlfriend and you've openly cried around her about bullshit, you can tell how uncomfortable it makes her. You can tell that she doesn't want to hear it. No matter how progressive she is, no matter how much she wants her boyfriend to be a sensitive soul, you can tell when she's like, oh no, something feels really wrong. You know, this, my boyfriend is crying over bullshit. So I think nobody wants anybody to cry over bullshit, but men in particular. And I just feel like there's a reason for that. But anyway, to get to that idea of, like, greater sacrifice, the idea of a warrior who sacrifices something, I want to get into that idea of sacrifice, because I think that is an important part of manhood. Not necessarily the act of sacrifice, but once again, the idea of it. That's, you know, an important theme that I consider in every aspect of my life. Is it the actual act the material manifestation, the material object, or is it the idea of it that is more important? And so often it is the idea of it. I mean, we're human fucking beings. Of course we value the idea of things more than we value the actual thing. It kind of defines us as a species, for better and for worse. But anyway, I swear I'm going to talk about sacrifice here. That scene in The Wheel of Time, it brought a tear to my eye that this guy who you otherwise might be mad at, it's like, that event that happened early in the story happened because he betrayed them, and you find out that it was him who betrayed them at the end of the book. But here he has an opportunity for redemption, and redemption is beautiful. And I'm not going to get into redemption. I can barely even get into sacrifice here. But this guy has a moment to sacrifice himself. And as the other good guys are fleeing, they can hear his shouts. They can hear him fighting off the 50 guys. And you know he dies. I sure hope he's dead. I hope in, like, book 5 that we don't find out he's alive. all those wasted tears. I cried for nothing. I cried for bullshit. I hope my girlfriend doesn't find out about this. But it brought a tear to my eye because it's just that sacrifice, and I will never get tired of that. In the cheesiest action movie, the cheesiest war movie, the guy who dives on the grenade. And it's one thing if diving on the grenade is going to 100% save your friends. In real life, that happens. A guy from my high school died in Iraq during the Iraq War. Let's hope it was during the Iraq War. I hope he didn't just die in Iraq randomly. But no, he died in Iraq. He dove on a grenade to save his platoon or his squad, whatever they were. And it was fucking beautiful to hear about. Awful. War is awful. But hearing that a man did that, that's so virtuous. Because sacrifice, to me, is the ultimate virtue. Boring sacrifice. Sacrificing bullshit for your children, that's just as virtuous, even if it's boring. Even if you sacrificed your music career so that your kid can push a little mini shopping cart and get in people's way, it's still virtuous. But there's something about hearing a story about a man diving on a grenade to save his squad, to save his platoon, that just does something to you. It taps into something ancient. And when I say ancient, I don't mean that long ago, because I don't feel like it was that long ago. I don't feel like our ancient feelings are that old. I don't feel like time is as long as we treat it. I don't feel like a million years ago is that long ago. And I just threw out a million there very arbitrarily. But still, I feel like we have things inside of us that date back to those times, and we act like it was some distant memory, when just the fact that it's still in us and we can feel it tells us that it's not old at all. It's, in fact, it's there, it's present, it's current. And I feel like whatever sacrifice does, whatever that brings out in us, when we witness it, when we hear stories about it, it's eternal. That's really what I'm getting at. It's not ancient. It's not an ancient feeling. It's an eternal feeling. And the real beauty of sacrifice, the real virtue, the true virtue, is not that diving on the grenade is going to save all your friends. The virtue is that you simply hope it does. And you do it anyway. You are trying to save your friends. The guy might dive on the grenade, and the grenade still blows up everybody in the room. But he tried to save his friends. He tried to muffle the explosion. He might dive on the grenade blows only him up, and then his friends get shot by the bad guy who have surrounded the building. Or, you know what I mean? Or they all hop on a plane and escape, and the plane crashes because a wing was damaged. You know, the just beautiful thing about sacrifice, the beautiful tragedy of sacrifice, is that it's not a surefire way to reach the goal behind the sacrifice. The purpose behind the sacrifice isn't guaranteed. Because, you know, I do have faith in humanity. I feel that we have, while not everybody is good and not everybody is courageous, I think there are enough good, courageous people out there that if sacrifice was surefire, if we were insured, if we were absolutely positive that we were going to get the result we desired when we made a sacrifice, I think a lot more people would do it, because I think a lot of people are good enough and courageous enough to do that. I think a lot of people would take that step to dive on the grenade, maybe, if they knew it would save their friends. But with sacrifice, you don't know. And that's why true sacrifice takes just an unbelievable amount of courage. It takes an unbelievable amount of courage and virtue to dive onto a grenade. I mean, you think about virtue and the idea that just it's simply expressing an opinion these days is treated like it's a virtue. Pointing something out is treated like it's a virtue. And people do it online. They don't even print it out. You know, they don't even print it out on inkjet paper. They don't even print their virtues out. They just type them online. You know what I mean? And here we have people who have done things that don't even guarantee a result, but they still did them because there was a chance. There was a chance that, you know, jumping in front of that spear might save your friend. Your friend might still get killed in 2 seconds later, but by jumping in front of that spear, you gave them a chance. There was some chance, and that is, it's almost beyond comprehension that so much sacrifice is just for the possibility that something good can come of it. I'm not saying everything, you know, many of us won't have opportunities to do that. Many of us won't have opportunities to literally risk our lives for people we love and care about. Or even bigger, like risking your lives for people that you don't know, risking your lives for strangers. People make insane sacrifices for total strangers. And, you know, just like I said that many sacrifices, especially the ultimate forms of sacrifice, are often done not knowing if it will guarantee a certain result. Think about the number of sacrifices that have happened that nobody's ever heard about. You know, if someone found those two bodies who had been killed with spears in some ancient battle, they don't know that one of those men jumped in front of the spear to save his friend first. You know what I mean? Their bodies don't reveal that. And that, to me, is an even... It's almost like you keep taking a couple steps back and the virtue just expands the more I talk about this, where it's like the idea of not just sacrifice for the possibility of something good, but a sacrifice that may never be acknowledged. You know, not doing it so that you could be a hero in stories. To go back to the Wheel of Time, the character who makes that sacrifice... He sort of corrupts his sacrifice just a little bit because he mentions before he does it, he says, like, this is the sort of thing that, you know, someone will talk about in one of the old stories. This is the sort of thing that someone will tell tales about, this, you know, fighting off 50 men and dying so that his friends can escape. But we all kind of live that way. You know, I don't think we would actually make the sacrifices we do if we didn't in some way want to be a part of lore. So I don't think there's anything wrong with necessarily having that in your mind. It's a little bit perverted. It's a little bit corrupt to be like, I'm going to dive on this grenade, and maybe there's a chance that someone will talk about this. Maybe there's some chance that, you know, people will remember this. I don't think it's wrong to think that way, and God knows I do. I do a fucking podcast. I'm not going to pretend that I'm not narcissistic. I'm not going to pretend that I don't have an ego. But still, I think somebody who does that not knowing if they will ever be remembered or does it and is not remembered is I don't know if there's much out there that's more virtuous than that. I was talking about manhood here. I really was. And I was also going to talk about madness. So to me, the ultimate form of manhood is that form of ultimate sacrifice. And there are many other things that, you know, to me embody what a man is and what a man should do. And one of those to me is being willing to take unlikely advice and wisdom from even your enemy, especially your enemy. Giving your enemy the benefit of the doubt is a big part of that. It doesn't mean making yourself weak. It doesn't mean laying yourself down. But I do think listening to your enemy, your so-called enemy, and being willing, not necessarily giving them the benefit of the doubt, but being willing to give them the benefit of the doubt is a very important part of what it is to be a man, and it forms the bigger picture of manhood. It doesn't mean in the end you may find that they were lying, you may find that they were wrong, but you have to be willing to give them the benefit of the doubt, and you have to be willing to listen to advice that might come from the most unlikely source. And I think the most unlikely source is often going to be the person you hate or you think you hate, or someone you simply find boring. I know that's more of a struggle for me and something that I try to work on, because I actually do like listening for insight from my enemies. I feel like the sort of passion you have for the people you admire and the people you really like easily translates to the people you absolutely don't like, because those absolutes catch your attention. When you have that kind of passion toward liking someone or admiring someone or disliking someone or hating everything that they embody, you are more likely to pay attention to either of them. But when someone seems boring, when something seems boring, that's when it's the hardest to pay attention and the hardest to listen. So I think there's a certain virtue, not just in, I got to get away from that word virtue. It's a loaded word. It was nice when I was talking about sacrifice, but let's leave it out. But in terms of, you know, being a man, you might be physically a man with that badge. Your silhouette has the shape of a man. But a man has to be willing to find insight and good and being willing to find gold essentially in the most boring lot of land. And that often happens with things that I'm just not interested in. You know, I mentioned how the father who sacrifices his own hobbies and interests or his own whatever for his child, how that's sort of a boring form of sacrifice. It's great and it's wonderful. And thank God for dads. Thank God for that. Thank dad for dads. Thank big dad for dads. I'm grateful for that. I'm grateful for the sacrifices my parents have made. I'm grateful for the sacrifices other parents make for making their children's lives better, for making better children, therefore making my life better. You know, when you raise your children well, it's not just doing you a favor, it's doing everybody a favor. So thank God for anybody who does that. But it's boring to me, but I also have to look at that and go, that story is boring to me. The story of the hardworking father just doesn't captivate me. And that's a little test. That's a little trial for me. And when something like that bores me, I have to remind myself, look a little closer. Look into that situation for ways. Look at what you can take from that story. It might not catch your eye, but try to take something from it. And that might not be the best example, because I think that's kind of obvious. I think it's obvious what we can take from good parents, the stories of hardworking good parents, especially when they've fought adversity. It's what fuels, talk shows. It's what fuels Oprah. There are entire book clubs based around reading books about that very subject. But we do have to look into something that bores you and be like, what is in that that could do something for me, and not just do something for me, but give me insight that I could then use to maybe benefit somebody else in some way. What could I use for my podcast? What in that boring story could I pull away and talk about on my podcast? That's all I do. I'm very self-serving. I'm just mining the world for my podcast here. No. But I think that's part of it. You know, I mentioned how, you know, you should be willing to listen to your enemies and give your enemies, being willing to give your enemies the benefit of the doubt, but you should also give the most boring things imaginable the benefit of the doubt, too. And, you know, I'm trying to think of other qualities that I think of when I think of what it means to be a man opposed to a boy. And once again, I will say it doesn't mean that women shouldn't do these things, and it doesn't mean that a woman who does these things is less of a man or less of a woman, or that this is some game I'm playing where it's like only men can do these things and these things only matter if men do them or any of that. And I hate that I even have to say that, but we live in a world where we're constantly, where people are looking for that. And once again, I will say benefit of the doubt. I really hope that anybody who ever potentially listens to this show, even if it's an alien monk with no dick, in the year 2070, I hope that they give me the benefit of the doubt and they don't try to look for those little holes in my story or try to look for where I'm offensive. Because I think that's another thing, too, is part of manhood is not trying to tear other people apart at the seams. You know, it's standing up for what you feel is right. I mean, it goes without saying, to the point where, like, that's probably the most boring thing I could say. Speaking of boring, standing up for what's right. You know, I think you should always stand up for things. You should always stand up for right and wrong. And even sometimes the things that exist between right and wrong need to be stood up for. But I think this idea of just nitpicking people doesn't work, and it doesn't make you feel like an adult when you do it. Let's get rid of man or woman. I don't think it makes you an adult when you just nitpick somebody and you try to find some, not fatal flaw in what they're saying or doing, but just some tiny little, it's like when you're trying to pinch somebody. You're trying to topple a giant, so you just pinch them. You know, I don't think that's a way to do it. I don't think that's a system that's worth using in your life. Just one sec. That refreshing sound we make, that's what a man does. He takes a sip and he goes, but I would like to return to the idea of sacrifice here for a second, yet again. And, because I want to talk about madness. I think this is going to be a long episode. And where men become mad and what madness is for a man. And let me talk about Wheel of Time again. Because one of the premises behind Wheel of Time is that there's essentially magic. It's called the one source, the true source, and people can channel it, but it's essentially magic, although the book never refers to it as magic. The series never refers to it as magic. And there's a group of women, essentially a society of women, who are basically witches. They're accused of being witches, but they're basically practitioners of magic. And in the lore of the book, in the history inside the book, inside the story, there used to be men who were the other half of that. Women can channel the true source using this sort of feminine ability. It has a specific name, and there's a certain way that women channel that magic. But men can channel magic using this masculine version of that. However, the society of men who could channel magic are extinct. And some men are born who can use it, but they are taken in by the women, the magical women, and what's called gentled. And that means their ability to use that magic is taken away. And the men, if it's not done soon enough, those men will eventually wither away and die. And that's because in this story, men who have the ability to use magic will eventually go mad. And the reason that the men are extinct, the magical men, the reason they're extinct, it's because they went mad. As a group, they went mad and they broke the world apart. In the lore of the book, it's called the Breaking of the World. And this group of men just went fucking crazy and they used their magic to destroy the world. And not for any purpose, because that's the madness of it all. Madness does not have a purpose. So much madness, though, comes from good intentions. You know, it's the path to hell, blah, 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 is paved with something, something. Path to hell is paved with the yellow brick road. You know, it's that whole good intentions idea where so often madness even if it doesn't have a purpose, it does come from some distortion of a purpose. And this book is funny because it doesn't have any kind of socio-political slant. It's not trying to say that men ultimately go power crazy and destroy the world if they're not kept in check. That's kind of the point, you know. But then the book, the main character in the book, it turns out, can channel magic, surprise, surprise. And it's him kind of going out into the world with this ability and trying not to go mad. And read into that how you want. But the book was written by a guy from the South. And he's not throwing in some, like, over-the-top feminist slant where all men eventually go crazy and destroy the world. But it's nice that this is a theme in the story without those socio-political overtones. It's just part of a story. And it is interesting how it relates to real life. Because I do think men, when they do let their quote-unquote magic go haywire and they don't keep it in check, I think they ultimately do destroy, and they destroy at a level that women don't. And in the same way that men, I think, are more prone to that virtuous sacrifice, I think men are more prone to those aggressive acts of heroism. And I call them aggressive in a good way because I think it takes a level of male aggression to actually to live out these heroic acts and deeds that we've heard about in stories, that we hear about in war. And it's not just limited to war. It could be in anything. It could be saving a cat from a tree. I don't know, a guy who climbs a tree, you know, with a down power line leaning against it so that he can save a cat. You know, there's a certain form of, it's a male daredevil aggression that I think leads to heroism. But I think it also goes haywire. And just like sacrifice can be diving on a grenade or doing something heroic, it can also be strapping a bomb to your chest and blowing up a school or blowing up a shopping mall. Because that's an important thing to remember, is that that same spike in adrenaline that someone feels when they are saving their friends and putting their own life at risk is the same adrenaline that a suicide bomber feels right before he blows himself up. And he believes that he is making a sacrifice for a greater good, and it's distorted. You know, you can say what you want about the U.S. military, and we do bad things too. We have our own distortions. I'm not saying that any particular group is always right or always wrong. But I think a great example is the idea of the suicide bomber who absolutely does feel he is doing something right. I don't think most people who do bad things sit there and think, I'm a bad guy. I'm going to go do a bad guy thing. Oh, I'm the bad guy in the story. Those exist. You know, serial killers, there are people who are willingly just being a bad guy. They are being dark. They are being a henchman of pure darkness. There are people who do that. But just like I think most people are basically good and courageous, and if probability was on their side, they would do more good and courageous things, I also don't think that most people who do bad things are necessarily bad guys. I don't think they all think, you know those henchmen in comic books who work for the Joker? I want to be more like them. I don't think they think that way. I think that they have a distorted view of virtue, and that's why you have to constantly keep yourself in check. And you can see where so many bad things that people do, so much madness that men do, ultimately comes from, you can almost see where they're coming from. You can see where it went wrong. You can see where the suicide bomber took something that some eternal, ancient, whatever word you want to say, something inside of us, some warrior spirit, and it's taken that and it's been poisoned by ideology. It's been poisoned by just a nasty, twisted form of culture, and it's turned into them blowing up shopping malls and schools, shooting up nightclubs, you know. It's turned into something very nasty, but they ultimately feel like they are serving a greater purpose. And I mean, I think you can even see that with, like, womanizing. I think you can see that with some of the behavior that men do. Yeah, a rapist is just a bad guy. Even if he doesn't, you know,
recognize his own behavior, even if he somehow can't see that what he's doing is rape. That's just a bad guy. But then you go down the ladder a little bit and you have a womanizer, someone who's deceptive, someone who lies, someone who cheats, infidelity, this or that. And that guy's not a rapist. He's not the worst of the worst. But he's taken something that is sort of, you know, could be seen as virtuous, being a man, you know, using your dick, because that's essentially what it is. You know, all men do have a desire for that in some to some capacity. But it's gone haywire. It's descended into madness, because sex addiction is madness. The idea of just trying to fuck everything and having no loyalty to your wife, to your friends, to anybody, jeopardizing your entire family. That is a form of madness. I mean, I look at, there was a school teacher at my junior high a couple of years before I went there, and Mark Bliley, look him up. And he had had sex with a girl who was in my carpool. Her brother was my age, and the girl was she was a year younger than my sister. So she was about 6 years older than I was. And she and her brother were occasionally in my carpool. The brother was on my soccer team. And he was the most popular teacher. I have my sister's old yearbooks from when she was at the junior high. He would get voted most popular teacher in the superlatives at the end of the year. You'd have a kid with best hair, most outgoing, most likely to, you know, play professional sports. You know, you'd have those kids, and then you'd have most popular teacher. And he was always the most popular teacher, Mark Bliley. And he was so popular that, you know, he impressed a young girl in the class, and they ended up having an affair. She was 15. He was well into his 40s, I think. They ended up having sex in Starbucks bathrooms, and her family hired a private investigator to track them down. Her little brother switched schools. I never saw him again. He changed his last name. Because this was big. This was a heavy cloud over those families. And the teacher's kids were the same age as the girl. And those kids stayed in the same schools with the same last name, and their dad went to prison for 5 years. He got out of prison, and they got married. Him and the girl that he slept with, the teenage girl that he slept with, got married after he got out of prison. And I believe they are now divorced. But that is madness. You know, what he did to his children, if nothing else. Not just what he did to this teenage girl, you know, he slept with this teenage girl, you know, abused his power as a teacher. I don't need to go on some, like, moral tirade about everything that's wrong with this situation. But I think you can see where there's a dust cloud of chaos and madness in that situation. And, you know, I had a pretty close view of it. It was in my immediate community, in my fucking carpool, you know what I mean? And it doesn't hit more close to home than your carpool. But that man, you know, did he feel like a man when he was sneaking into Starbucks restrooms with a 15-year-old girl? Did he feel like a man doing that? I don't know, but I know that what he was really feeling was just madness. And that all came from a place, like, he probably liked the girl. From what I gathered, both of them gave interviews after they got married. She was an adult. She said, you know, she didn't feel like he ever groomed her, that they just had this connection and all this. And, you know, I don't even know what to say about that. I don't even know what to say about that marriage. But it was a marriage made in madness, that's for sure. But you can see where it's like this desire for, you know, as a man, it's like part of what makes you a man is this desire for love, sex, love, whatever it is. It's all kind of mixed up. But you can see where that just gets so twisted. You think about someone like Doug Hutchinson, the actor who was in The X-Files. I was talking to a friend about this. He was the actor in the Squeeze and Tombs episodes, which are the best X-Files episodes. The true X-Files movies is those two episodes put back to back from the first season. Squeeze and Tombs. But Doug Hutchinson ended up getting involved with this 16-year-old girl from my area, from Tacoma, just a town away, basically. And they had a reality show. They were on interviews. I don't remember if they had their own reality show, what it was, but it was just this, like, really disgusting, like, public, this PDA sort of relationship. Like, he's like a 50-year-old man and she's 16, and they're like making out in front of TV cameras and just all over each other. It was, you know, it was just strange and disgusting. Not even on a moral level, just on a purely aesthetic level, on just a visual level, just seeing that. And that's another form of that madness. But it's ultimately, these are men who I guess were on a quest for some form of love or sexual validation. And those things are okay. But you see where just the logical conclusion, when you don't keep yourself in check, when your insecurities and your pathologies go haywire, it turns into just pure madness. Or you think about the guy who just wants to defend his home and defend his family, but he becomes so paranoid that he ends up, you know, killing the newspaper boy. You hear stories about stuff like that, like some guy, he thinks a burglar's breaking in and it was just like a kid delivering newspapers. You know, and that was coming from some place of like wanting to protect his family. But paranoia is, you know, is a madness that comes from hypervigilance. Because some would even say hypervigilance is a form of madness. But I'm a hypervigilant person, and I feel like hypervigilance is better than being straight up paranoid. But let's just say vigilance. You can see where vigilance is virtuous, where, you know, wanting to protect, wanting to be aware, keeping aware of your surroundings, trying to maintain a safe boundary around your home, around your family, where that can get twisted up and it can descend into this madness. And I feel like in almost every case of male madness, it ultimately comes from some place that could, if not distorted, be good. And that doesn't mean that we should see it as good. When someone does something horrible, we shouldn't say, well, you know, if you put it through the undistortion machine and straighten it back out, we can kind of see where somewhere the intention was good. I'm not saying that at all. I don't think that's true. Because I think once these things get distorted and they reach just the full bloom of madness, there's really no going back. And maybe that's all it takes to be a man. Maybe manhood just means keeping your madness in check. Screw sacrifice. Screw, you know, being willing to listen to your enemy. Screw all this stuff I was saying. Maybe being a man is just keeping that madness in check.
This land is mine. God gave this land to me. This brave, this golden land to me. And when the morning sun reveals her hills and plains, I see a land where children